Part 3. Dwi Hor. Chapter 9.
So,
Eodren leant forwards over the waxy orange leaf that had been folded in half to serve as a table, hand cupped around a mollusk shell stained blue inside with dark Corlep wine. The half a dozen emptied shells to precede it had worked to progressively loosen the muscles of his face. His eyes were as big and watery as fish eggs. His words were clumsy.
"How many Deepkin have you killed?"
Morrigai turned porcelain white features towards him, then away again. Needles flashed over the torn set of fish-scale leggings in her lap. They had belonged to one of Nael's thralls, ripped by an auric arrow on the Isurian cape.
"She won't answer you, Eodren," Lurien said.
"She has a voice. I heard it on the cliffs."
Lurien looked down into his own Corlep shell and shuddered. The Deepkin shunned material things and abhorred sensation, but that which dulled the nerves slowed the mind. That was a gift to be cherished. Dwi Hor's nightshade Corlep was a case in point, a superior variety of the common sea grape, nurtured by the occasional splashes of sunlight that reached the vineyards of its shallower seas, and the unstoppable fecundity that came with its shared border with the lands of the Radiant Queen. But Lurien had not drunk nearly enough of it to numb the memory of Coryza. He did not need the reminder.
"Let it go," he said.
Eodren took a gulp of Corlep.
"She could show me on her fingers,"
he demonstrated, holding up 10. Morrigai carried on sewing.
"More than 10?
Eodren drawled in horror.
"I said stop it," said Lurien.
With a frown, Eodren flounced back into the creamy green pith cushion of his living chair.
"When did you become so joyless, my prince? If one cannot taunt the Namartai, then what is the point of being alive at all?"
Morrigai's needles paused. They quivered in her tiny hands like arrows in skin. Lurien tensed, but it lasted only a moment before the Namartai was back at her work. He let his breath slide out. The three of them occupied a table in the gloomy dining lounge of the Lenlui, a taberna whose name, depending on context and intonation, could mean either the living or the dead. The huge roots of living trees vaulted the ceiling, casting broad shadows from the smattering of green-stained glowstones that illuminated the space. Lurien was still acclimating himself to the idea of a structure tailored solely to the comfort of visitors. The oceans were too vast to be travelled freely. The magic of the tidecasters guarded too jealously by the Isharan fanes, but visitors had still come to Dwi Hor. Its location on the coast had made it a trading hub of sorts, by Deepkin standards. There had even been a skink ambassador here once, much fated by Mabhor, according to the Lenlui's aged proprietor, but that was well in the past now. Every so often the roots of the taberna would creak, shift a little as the growing trees stretched, tremors running through the small enclosure of water to make Lurien, and before inebriation had steadied his nerves, Eodren, grip the edges of their leaf table and look nervously about them, as if the ceiling were about to fall in. Dwi Hor was an enclave under siege, these tides, he knew. The closest of the Green Gulch's enclaves to the lands of Gairan, it was the first to hear the growing stridency of the Ever Queen's war song, and the first to feel the expansion of her borders. Schools of wild fish, predatory and unbound, swirled through its arbours, darting in and out of the contorted bowls from which Dwi Hor's corallous fane shaped their dwellings. Deepwood spites, whether out of mischief or sheer malevolence, would often caper ahead of such shoals, luring them around armed patrols and into the homes of the Eidoneth before dissolving back into the magic of the Deepwood. The few Eidoneth who still lived there were a tenacious breed and uncommonly grim, although they had a peculiar way of expressing it. Their skin carried the russet hue of red algae, or new wood,
and they had taken to the wearing of bright and disjointed colours, further ornamented with berries and silver and noise-making shells. They also took the unthinkable precaution of moving about their enclave in large groups. Some combination of close-quarters living, bitter defeat, constant encroachment by the Ever-Queen of Gairan and their sovereign's slow descent towards Malachi had left the Dwi-Hor accursed, distracted folk. Keeping an eye on the door, Lurien took a cautious sip of Corlep. An Amartai woman garbed in a stiff leather jerkin, parti-coloured and decorated with bark, swam to Lurien's table with a wooden tray in one hand. Her baldness made her ears seem longer and more pointed. The namastir on her forehead was traced with silver. The hadril car about her neck was of thick, aged wood rather than metal, the spreading bower of Dwi-Hor encompassing a host of lesser runes, displaying the Idoneth to whom she belonged, the incubati that had nursed her, the soul warden that had furnished her soul, and the raid leader who had claimed it. She was beautiful, in spite of her advanced years, not in any spectacular way, but all elves were creatures of innate beauty. He did not look at her twice. Eadrin leant back as the woman swam over the table to gather up his empty shells. He frowned at her as she left, casting the same critical eye over the Lenlui's aged proprietor, hovering behind the bar. Blearily he gazed over the handful of grim, haunted patrons that occupied the other nooks and hides of the lounge. "Everyone here is so old," he said. "Marpor doesn't raid any more," said Lurien. "There have been no new souls in decades, and no new souls means no new Namata." He looked around. "And Namatai only live 30 or 40 years, so you can understand why."
"And why doesn't he raid?"
"I don't know exactly. I heard that he used to be prolific, that he would lead his phalanx deeper into land than even Galdra here or Vanglaer are forced to go today. I don't know why he stopped. But I remember Mother telling me something about a particularly bad defeat he suffered at the hands of the Silverneth, maybe 20 years ago, just before the raids stopped." Eodraine shrugged.
"Sometimes a raid goes bad."
"As if you would know," Lurien sneered. "In any case, it was a disaster, as I recall, and hundreds of Arkelian were slain, their souls lost, and Marpor himself lost some kind of Ironrack heirloom after being bested in combat by the Silverneth Tree Lord."
"And now he's mad."
"Now they're all mad." Lurien again cast an eye to the door. With a sigh, Eodraine drained his corlip shell. He pushed himself up from the table. "Where do you think you're going?" said Lurien.
"I have drunk enough, corlip."
Lurien snorted. "Someone find the soul scryer potentate. The end of days is upon us."
"You can wait here as long as you want for your Namatai witch. Well, this is my first time in Dwi-Hor, and I intend to explore it fully."
His fumbling eye caught the old serving wench on her meandering return to the bar, and he grinned lazily.
"I wonder if there's a sample of surface dweller spirit left over from this place's halcyon days."
And then he stumbled off in the general direction of the bar.
"Stay inside!"
Lurien shouted after him. With a sigh, he turned to Moragai, who had remained quiet, intent only on her seamstressing throughout the entire exchange.
"So," he said, "how many deepkin have you killed?"
She shook her head. Checking over his shoulder to ensure that Eodraine was well out of hearing and that none of the Dwi-Hor had ventured any nearer, Lurien leant forwards. "Did you kill Nael in Coriza?" No answer. The click-clack of needles. "Because Filenduil suggested that a Namatai could have seen through his glamours, but Namariel was right there beside me the whole time. But then there you were."
"I did not kill him."
Her voice was as quiet as a whisper in a fane, and just as unexpected.
I hear the voice of my thoughts, and then I find them dead.
What does that mean?
She stared blankly into his skull.
And if I were to wish for you to find a dead man for me, or a dead woman?
But the girl was mute again. She turned away. Click, clack.
Uriel pushed in the heavy doors. There was a howl of discordant music and screaming elves that was quickly muted again as the big Namatai leant back onto the doors to shut them. He breathed out, relieved. The Namatai had made every effort to blend in, his huge muscles hennaed in the Dwi-Hor style, albeit at Lurien's suggestion, with the turquoise and gold of Briamdar. The colours were a better match for his skin than the lighter shades favoured by the dark-skinned Dwi-Hor, and to any casual observer, it would clearly mark the elf as Lurien's.
"Is it still bad out there?"
Lurien asked.
Uriel peeled himself from the door and swam towards them. He pulled up a chair.
"Worse."
"You were able to make all of the arrangements, at least."
"I found a Tidecaster who was lucid enough to talk. He's prepared to send the armour back to Elgaean."
Lurien sat back and held up his hands, admiring again the nacreous lustre of the vambraces. How well the harness had fit to his body once its former occupant's disease-hollowed bones had been removed. It was so very much finer than the inferior half-plate that Laramie had gifted to him. Filenduel had protested, and some of the reavers had muttered, but as he had explained to them, there was surely no other elf in the Seven Oceans that the White Queen of Elgaean would prefer to wear it now that Nael was no more. He was the heir to Elgaean now, after all, and the true king of Briamdar. She would probably thank him for being courteous enough to return her earlier gift to him.
"The price is not going to spoil the taste of this fine corlep in my mouth, I hope," he said.
"Those Fangmores that came back riderless from the Cape, and the promise of a good word with Queen Laramie. Some of the thralls will go back as well to advise the Queen of what happened."
"That Kaelar and 300 souls will be returning to Elgaean in a month or so?"
Uriel nodded.
"And how I led the raid after my cousin fell?"
"Namariel insisted on it. She wanted Laramie to hear her telling of events before she heard Kaelar's."
"What do they intend to tell her about the manner of Nael's fall?"
"I left that with Namariel."
Lurien brushed Nael's sword hilt with his fingertips, where it rested against his hip under the half-leaf table. Elgonite armour, Elgonite blade, Turak steed. The colours of Briamdar still fresh in his skin, he was becoming a walking token of fealty from the enclaves of the Green Gulch. And having twice now been reliant on a borrowed blade from Eodraine, he had come around to the virtues of having two.
"What about the rest of the Namatai?" he said.
"Coming with us, I suppose."
"Better than going on with just the five of us."
Uriel smirked.
"You are a prince, after all."
Lurien's slightly drunken smile grew a little wider about the middle.
"The reavers did prove useful in Carriza, and it will be novel to have someone else to carry my belongings when we move on."
He thought about it a moment longer.
"It will be novel to have belongings."
The two elves looked up as another Namatai approached their table. It was the proprietor that Lurien had noticed glaring at Eodren earlier. He looked ancient, skin folded like some kind of sponge and pickled in brine, clad in split-sided robes that bared his cringingly thin legs as he swam. His neck was noticeably lengthened, rubbed raw by the weight of his Hadrilkar. Lurien put his hand over his still half-full corleb shell and shook his head. Moragai, of course, had no shell in front of her, and none was offered to Uriel. It was accepted that a Namatai might sit alongside their Arkelian masters in public, since most were dependent on their thralls, but to dine alongside them would have been unthinkable, even in Dwi-Hor.
"May I take an order of food to the kitchens, my lord?"
Lurien opened his mouth to say that, yes, he was hungry enough to eat a charged Fangmora.
You may not, said Ureo.
The older Namatai glanced at Lurien, who nodded reluctantly, and then swam back to the bar. Lurien turned to Ureo.
I've seen the kitchens, the Namatai explained. The food here isn't good.
What do you know of good food?
I was head cook in Tormathlan for 5 years.
You were a cook?
Is that so hard to believe?
I took you for a metal crafter or a mine worker, maybe.
Why?
Well, Lurien gestured to the great limestone white slab of him.
Have you ever carved iron squid tentacle? Or been asked to serve merwhile while it's still fresh?
Lurien shook his head. Ureil sat back, the elegant bowering of his chair creaking with his weight. He folded his hands behind his head as if to display the full glory of his pectoral muscles and biceps.
You'd think we would have eaten better, said Lurien.
Ureil snorted and Lurien began to laugh. Bitterly. There was a flap of curtain from one of the corner hides and Lurien turned, expecting to see a briefly satiated Eodrain sauntering back to the table, but it was only Filenduil being led by the hand by Namariel.
Give him your call-up.
Namariel sat the old tidecaster down, her hands firmly over his shoulders.
His need is greater.
What did you do to him? The Isharan's eyes were huge and staring. His bottle-green skin had turned almost white.
I'm flattered, said Namariel. But this is Caravinia's doing, not mine.
She patted Filenduil's shoulders. He moaned, sniffling softly.
I think his soul has been sickened by the taint of Coriza.
She smiled cruelly.
Or at least he fears it enough to believe it. I'm not convinced. It would be rare for so brief an exposure to overcome the constitution of an elf, particularly a deepkin sheathed in protective ethersy.
She shrugged.
But I may have promised him a bushel of the famed restorative berries of the deep woods if he were to help us earn the favour of Marpor. Just be grateful I was able to persuade him of the merits of your cause. There are worse things for a renegade prince to hold in his pocket than a pet tidecaster.
Lurien nodded. Every fane of the Isharan Terskull played its role in the survival of the enclaves. But if an Ideneth wanted to cross oceans, strike at land or conduct diplomacy or trade between distant enclaves, it was a tidecaster they needed. Lurien handed his corlep shell to Ureil, who, in turn, patiently squeezed open the uncooperative elf's mouth and poured the nightshade blue liquid inside. Then he pushed Filenduil's jaws closed again. The tidecaster coughed, corlip juice puffing out from the corners of his mouth and squirming away into the water.
"Stay with him, Ureil," said Namariel. "You too, Morrigai. If anyone asks, you're his."
The two Namatai nodded.
"What about Eodrain?" said Lurien.
"Eodrain knows how to amuse himself, I think," said Namariel.
"So what are we doing?"
Namariel nodded towards the door.
"What we came to Dwi-Hor to do, my prince, enlist the aid of the Laughing King."
Sunlight dappled on the submerged groves of Dwi-Hor, and where it touched on the sea floor, there rode a wild hunt. Elves in motleys of sea leaves and wood armour capered over every greyed-out blemish that appeared, waving weapons and war banners, scattering in a profusion of colour with wails of madness as it passed. Elves in fish-head masks and rippling cloaks, elves cavorting in rigid suits of deep-wood bark, like wilder spirits from some alien realm. It was as though some intoxicant had been spiked into the water here, gold-coloured and fleeting, elves whirling about one another in furious abandon, arm in arm, the dark water fizzling and pulsing with the malfeasance of the arbor's deep spites, the occasional scream. It was what insanity tasted of. A voltaic charge running through the water, energizing something deeper than skin.
the war song of Alariel, bouncing off every tree, ringing through the unfathomably deep water down to the ocean's bones. In the ocean-dimmed light of the day, they stood revealed to her, the twisted misfits of Teclis's creation that they were. And so they danced, masked and masqueraded. They danced to war. Lurien held on to the huge gnarled door-jamb of the Lenlui all he could do to keep himself from swimming out to join the Dwi Whore in the carnival of despair.
"Dwi Whore,"
Lurien hissed.
"Tell me again why I even want their aid." "They are diminished, but there is a kind of strength in their misfortune."
Namariel lifted her arms above her head, her lithe dancer's body already beginning to move to the undercurrent. Her training with the Corallus dancers of the Nathir must have made her more receptive to Marpor's strain of madness, or her Namatai senses were somehow more attuned to it. Lurien wondered if she even realized what she was doing. "Perhaps you should wait inside with Moragai and Uriel."
"And let you talk with Marbor alone?"
Namariel twirled, her long cloak whipping gracefully around her body. Lurien could not help but stare.
"Do you think I did not see how you tried to meet with Larame without me back in Elgaen?" she said. "I know you hoped that she would help rid you of me."
"Is it strange for an elf to sit alone with his favourite aunt?" Namariel laughed, her voice taking on a duskier quality as she danced.
"Marbor lost almost all his Achillean, but his court is filled with Isharan of dark and terrible powers."
"So I hear."
"I'm sure one of them could break our bondage if you were to beg it of them."
"I wouldn't dream of it."
"But Marbor never sets foot in his palaces. He is a dark circus that roams his enclave and its outposts, always riding down the sunlight."
Lurien looked over the unsettling carnival around them. "Then he'll be somewhere nearby. That's something."
"Come, my love," she declared,
and for the first time since they had been joined together in the dungeons of Briomdar, she said those last words as though they might mean something. Lurien felt a frisson of madness's energy enter him, running through his skin as she whirled away.
"Let us seek him out."
"Wait!" Lurien grabbed after her trailing wrist. "I still think it would be better if you waited for me in the Lenlui."
"And I think it would be better if we danced."
Stronger than him, she drew him from the porch step and into a pirouette, her laughter colder than an algal eclipse of the sun. Lurien was versed in all the courtly dances of the Briomden, the Avarai, the Sarail, even the Traeger. His skills had been spoken of with admiration, and he was certainly nearer his element in the ballroom of a royal assembly than at crossed swords in the court of the blind king. But he had never known a dance so tactile, so visceral, as that which Namariel described for him now. She spun him as though he were a coloured ribbon wielded by an Aeolus dancer, drawing with every movement of her body the silent tale of downfall and disgrace. A victory lament went up from the surrounding elves as the work of distant waves caused the scattering of sunlight to move elsewhere. Hunting horns were sounded, banners furled, and like a great school of fish startled by the shadow of a predator, the carnival broke apart to charge after it. With an athleticism that Lurien could only envy, Namariel spun away from him. He was too dazzled by her to notice her getting away.
"Namariel!"
Snapping out of the daze, he kicked off after her. Desperate swimmers bumped and jostled as he joined them in their wild hunt, whirling limbs, kicking feet. Dwi Whore covered too vast an expanse of forest to be considered crowded, even by the standards of most Eidoneth. But the frenetic convergence of 1,000 elves and the deep spites that followed the hunt in order to mock and molest its efforts made for a dizzying swirl of jewels, shells, jolts of garanic energies and gamine elven bodies.
"Namariel!"
Someone caught his arm around the bicep and pulled him around. He turned, expecting to see Namariel, only to be confronted instead by an old male elf with red-brown skin. His attire was a net, stuffed with sea berries and leaves. Lurien could not even tell if he was true-souled or Namatai, his face masked by a plank of wood, whorled with a multitude of painted eyes and splayed with horns. He danced a turn with Lurien before handing him off into the embrace of another, and another, and then another, around and around. Namariel! He pushed back against the hands of a would-be partner and looked around. The solitary dancer caught his eye. Alone amongst the profusion of colours and wild garb, he was clad in beryl-coloured splint mail with gloves, boots and a hooded cloak that concealed his face. Despite the fact that he danced alone, he did so with a ferocity the equal of any elf around him.
"Mabor,"
Lurien hissed, and swam towards him. He had barely kicked his feet once before a crone of a dancer dragged him back. He kicked her in the face with a snarl and almost laughed as she recoiled in shock. He turned back to where the Laughing King had been, but the elf had vanished into the carnival.
"Curse of Teclis on them all!"
He turned again, somehow still spinning, even without hands over him. Mail glittered, frills shivered.
"Faster, faster!"
Namariel's white skin, Mabor's cloak. He swam towards it. The water immediately in front of him burst into emerald fire as a deep spite manifested in his path. The spirit was a living contusion of magical energies and basic sentience, a squirming life-thing of no definite shape. It cackled and gibbered as it repositioned itself to thwart Lurien's efforts to swim around it, before apparently deeming him poor sport, delivering a slap of etheric power that sent him cartwheeling to the sea floor and the unyielding arms of an elven king.
"I know you," said Mabor.
Lurien stared in amazement, certain that the Malachi that had afflicted Namariel had finally overcome him as well. The Laughing King whirled around him with surprising agility, entering into the first movements of the Yulaher. Tall, achingly slender, clad in dark green mail and wooden plates, draped in cloak and hood, the Laughing King of Dwi Hor bowed.
"I know you as well," said Lurien.
"The currents have carried you a long way from the Cranstock, Prince Lurien."
Before Lurien could think of a response, a great shoal of dervish thrall dancers armed with hook-bladed Krultan spears descended to englobe him and the Mad King. Lurien looked up as the eyeless thralls whirled about one another, each dancer moving to a solitary routine, but at the same time part of a collective that was breathtaking in its choreography. They were wild and tattooed, long-limbed, beautiful, their narrow faces harbouring a cruelty and a focus on the moment that set them apart from the mere brilliance of their fellow elves. Their grace was devastating. In spite of their blindness, their hypnotic routines, said to be capable of reducing the most brutish of killers to awed disarmament before hooked blades darted from the lissom shoal to end them. Turak had its Asglir, Briomdar and Elgaen their all-powerful Isharan. Dwi Hor had its deep wood hook-weavers. Lurien understood he was a madman's word from death. Automatically he mirrored Marphor's movements. The Yulaher was a courtly dance of the Ionrach, in which elves of high status swam in wide arcs around the narrower, swifter circles of the lesser nobles. Since Marphor had taken for himself the role of lord, Lurien assumed the supplicant part. It was an unfamiliar position, but he still knew the movements.
"I have come to seek your aid."
"This I know.
I already have the backing of Larume of Elgaen, or soon will."
"This too I know."
With a rustle of leaves and a gasp of tiny bubbles, Mabhor broke off and spun away.
Lurien correctly mirrored the pirouette, peeling off in the opposite direction before returning to the cowled face of the Laughing King after half a dozen perfectly executed turns. Marphor nodded, impressed.
You can dance. I'm a prince. I've practiced. Perhaps we can be of some help to one another after all.
Of course, said Lurien. What can I... Marphor closed the distance between them before Lurien could finish. The water rushed in after him, flurrying his cloak around Lurien's legs, as he took the startled prince by the collar of his armour and drew him towards him. The sudden forward motion caused his hood to fall away. Marphor's scarred, painfully emaciated head was covered in leaf-pattern tattoos, similar to his hookweaver's. But what took Lurien aback, what robbed him of any will to resist Marbor's manhandling, was the fervid emerald of the king's eyes. He was not laughing. He was not even smiling. It looked as though all the energy in the elf's face, in his body, belonged to those two eyes.
You can help me win back my enclave, he said.
Too intimate, too close.
Retake it. From the forest.
Marbor's fierce eyes darted up, then back.
Since I lost Eslekai in battle with Quathor, the forest has sought advantage from my weakness. It knows I can't raid without it. It knows. It knows.
He pushed Lurien off him with a sneer, as though remembering too late to be offended by their touch, then pointed up to the surface. He turned his face to follow it.
See how she sends the sun to watch me? There! Did you see it?
He was raving now, his eyes drilling into Lurien's with too much intensity to be comfortably met.
Why do you think I took a soul pod from the Quethene's nursery groves? The Sylvaneth, Deep Grove.
Your mistress? Marbor laughed. Too loud. Too long.
What is Eslekai?
Said Lurien. Marbor grabbed him again.
The child of light. The soul taker. The soul keeper. How can you, a prince, heir to Lagithe, not know? The first Ironrach princess to voyage into the Green Gulch and declare herself Queen of Turak bore it with her, and it has been passed down through her family and into mine for over 1,000 years. Nor was she the first to wield it, no. All the way back to the Kaithai of Gealrakai it goes, hoarding the souls of its wielders lest they fall, unable to find the peace of the Corileum. And now it is lost to the Quethene of the Ironbark Glade. 20 generations of my ancestors, their wisdom, their power...
He covered his face with his hands as if his skull were about to explode.
Return my spear to the sanctuary of the deep, Prince Lurien, and you will have my backing against any enemy. I will throttle Van Glyer with my bare hands. I will dance through the hidden gloaming for you.
Brushing the Mad King off, Lurien made the protective ward of Mathlan over his chest. How am I supposed to reclaim a relic that cost you an entire army to lose?
I have something they want.
Lurien thought about it. Deep Grove. Marbor sealed Lurien's lips with a finger.
I have a plan. But later.
I'm ready now, said Lurien, spitting Marbor's finger from his lips.
Now... The light of the Radiant Queen falls upon Dwihor, brave prince. Now we ride to oppose it. Now we dance.